thing on first. Good morning. I can skip the first part of my talk where I was going to sing all my praises and tell you everything about me because Steve has pretty well taken care of that. But I've been working with students for 35, 36 years now, and a good majority of those have been students who were having problems, difficulties of some kind. The children I work with now are primarily Hispanic or migrant children, and these definitely have problems. Even the most well-adjusted of these children are apt to become delinquent because they can't get scholarships, they can't further themselves, and they realize that by the time they're about ready to graduate, and so they have a myriad of problems as well. During 35 plus years of working with children, I've encountered many children showing delinquent tendencies. Early intervention can help bring about changes in their behavior, but changing their attitudes and behavior patterns becomes more difficult as the child ages. Children form habits, attitudes, and perceptions early, and these are reinforced by the community surrounding the child. The community includes all immediate family members, the extended family, the entire school population, the town, city, or rural area in which the child lives, the church he may or may not attend, the media the child accesses, and any other people with whom he has even the slightest contact. A child is molded early. We only have to watch a show like The Nanny to see that some children are taught or learn at a very early age to be abusive, cheats, thieves, chronic liars, disrespectful, aggressive, and many other delinquent behaviors. Some children are or become problematic due to chemical reasons or to a variety of syndromes, and these children are not the ones that I'm talking about today. They actually require medical attention or intervention. Today our discussion will center on children who begin demonstrating delinquent behavior at a fairly early age, but for whom there is hope that with intervention, this behavior will at least be modified so they can be responsible, contributing adults. When I worked with a day treatment program for juveniles, a place where students have treatment and educational programs during the day and then return home at night, I noticed that when children come into that program or came into that program, they did not all respond the same way. Some came in, and no matter what their problems, they conformed immediately to what was expected of them. Others came in, and they tried every patience that anybody ever had with the things that they would do. But they were very intelligent, very capable of placing blame on others and not quickly caught in a lie. And staff had to be constantly on guard and adept at being consistent and working as a team. Unfortunately, because our program only worked with students and not with the schools they were going back to or with the parents, many of these children reverted to their previous behaviors immediately upon leaving the program. For years after teaching in that program, I saw the names of former students in the paper, usually being arrested and some sent to prison. But then there were some students who were successful. I can think in particular of one boy who was in my self-contained classroom. He completed the day treatment program and he attended a local high school. Before he left that high school, my wife Kay and I both became teachers there. And we actually had him in class again. He was popular. He played football. He got along just fine. And recently, he was featured in our local paper as an outstanding coach for Little League for the last 13 years, which I thought was just a wonderful thing. His brother, on the other hand, had more and more problems upon leaving the program. And although they had the same family, other circumstances helped determine the outcome. A delinquent child is not the child who, although he or she loves family, feels the need to rebel from time to time. You are all going to have those children. That child might get a body part pierced and be sorry later. They'll tell a fib and feel guilty, question authority to a degree, hide a tattoo, be argumentative, and perhaps make more than a few bad decisions. Some rebellious behavior is natural for a child as he grows older and wants to be seen more as an adult. But he still holds family in his heart and knows where home and help is. A child who likes to blame parents, school, and society for his problems, who says he is not accountable or responsible for his actions, who surrounds himself with friends who are similar, or friends that he can manipulate to get what he wants, is delinquent. He may steal, cheat, and reject authority figures. He may become addicted to drugs, sex, and alcohol. At school, he may be considered just plain mean. He will drop out of activities he doesn't want to do, and if things at home don't go his way, he'll run away. Juvenile delinquency is the legal term for any child whose behavior is such that if he were an adult, the behavior would be judged criminal. One offense often displayed by juvenile delinquents, however, would not be considered criminal, and that is running away. The causes of the behavior juvenile delinquents display are complex, involving psychological, social, and economic factors. No one can give a definitive reason because some children being raised under similar conditions grow to be responsible adults, while others display antisocial behavior. Clinical studies show persistent patterns of disorganized family units among many delinquents, but it's difficult to say whether these patterns came first and led to the behavior of the child, or if the antisocial antics of the child may have so stressed the family unit that the structure falls apart. In 1991, the following described the delinquent youth who were found in jail. The average age was 16, 93% were boys, 54% were white, and 40% black. More than 70% came from homes with only one parent. Half had family members who had been locked up. 20% have two or more close relatives who have served time. Almost 25% had fathers in jail or prison in the past year. Only 42% completed eighth grade, compared with 70% of other youth. Almost half had been taking drugs or drinking when they committed the crime. About 40% were locked up for violent crimes such as murder and rape. And 40% of that group had used a deadly weapon. These children may not sound like children who could possibly come from homes where the Bible is used and where people go to church. But delinquency knows no boundaries. It occurs in homes that are totally dysfunctional, in ghettos, in middle-class homes, and among the wealthiest. It occurs among the children of atheists as well as among children of Christians. It can be found in families that are permissive, extremely strict, or somewhere in between. These statistics make it sound as if delinquency only occurs during the teens, and that is not the case. Everyone who has had more than one child knows that every child seems to have his or her own her own personality at birth. Some babies are fussier than other babies. Some seem to always be content. Children often begin to show many of the behaviors of a delinquent to a lesser degree at a much earlier age. And parents need to be aware of what is going on with their child. At the age of 3 and 4 or earlier, some children have learned to control their parents, and the parents are at a loss as to what to do. A mother at my school once told me that she had to let her 6-year-old play with a gun and smoke, because that's what he wanted to do. She didn't know how to stop that behavior. Another child at about age 6 and later on as well would take her clothes off when the school bus came so that the mother couldn't put her on the bus, couldn't carry her out and physically put her on the bus. Actually, this mother brought that child to school in a car one day in that condition and called me out. And I went out and made that kid put her clothes on and carried her into the schoolhouse to class. These children rule the roost. The boy's now in prison, but not before fathering several children who are being raised by his mother. And the girl, luckily, had 2 interventions. But not until middle school, because that's when the mother finally agreed there was a problem. The court system became involved with mom and the school, providing the mother with help in learning how to parent. And the child gave the child a mentor counselor. And the child was made to come to an after-school program, of which I was director, by the courts. And she became very involved with the role models that we had hired there and that volunteered there. Her grades and attendance improved immensely. She never missed a day of that program. Therefore, she couldn't miss school, because she wasn't allowed to come if she wasn't in school that day. The point is that delinquency doesn't wait to start until a child hits the teenage years. It usually is becoming full-blown by that time. Every child has needs that, if met, hopefully will lead him or her to become a responsible member of society instead of a delinquent. Attachment to parents on an ongoing basis, if not parents' attachment to some individual who will be there for the child. Every child needs to develop trust. They need to be able to empathize with others. They need to be able to share. We've got a 2-year-old. He's learning to share. Not very well sometimes, but he's learning. Children have to be able to accept responsibility, and they need their self-esteem validated. But there are things that children don't need, and those are disruptions in their life. Disruptions in attachments. It's not always possible to avoid these, but some can be avoided. Divorce, separation, desertion, non-support, single parenting, foster care. Disruptions by adults such as physical or sexual abuse, verbal abuse, those kind of issues. And disruptions outside the home with their peers, schools, teachers, and classmates. Of course, family is always the first to be blamed for a child's behavior. In the Old Testament, children who were delinquent when they would not honor their mother and their father. And provisions were made for those children to be stoned. But apparently stoning didn't always work, because we continue to read about this kind of behavior, even with, like, the children of David. Lack of a cohesive family unit seems to play a role in many of delinquents' decisions, especially those in which there is no father figure. The proportion of children living in single-parent homes more than doubled between 1970 and 2003. Over 32% of children live in single-parent or non-traditional marriage homes. That's about 3 out of 10. Most of the single parents are women, although the number of single men has increased from 9 to 17%. And many of these parents, 41%, have never married. Children living with both parents are less likely to live above the poverty level, more likely to live below it. And children living with only their mothers in 2003 lived in poverty more often than children living only with a father. Is it society's responsibility to do something to keep children from becoming delinquent? Some people think so, and there are good programs out there. The Office of Juvenile Justice has offered grants to sponsor after-school programs to try to keep children safe between the hours of 3 and 6, which is when most crimes by youth are committed. These programs offer role models and caring adults that are there for the children. Often the church is named as part of the reason for a child's rebellion. A child resents being forced to go to church and do something that he considers a waste of time. That is especially true if he realizes that his parents feel that same way. Children catch on quickly and usually understand the intentions of their parents. Our children are bombarded daily with messages that say, to be accepted, you need to be part of a crowd. And the crowd is usually not very intelligent, drinks, has little or no respect for authority. Wouldn't it be great if there really was an easy button? Staples is really promoting that lately, but an easy button for raising children? We could just push it every time a problem arose, and the answer would be there. Unfortunately, children do not come into this world with a manual on how to rear them. There is no easy button, so forget about looking for a quick fix. Parents must start before birth and work continually every day, being vigilant, consistent, and proactive to make sure they know their child, they know where their child is, and they know what their child is doing. According to Kimberly A. Gordon Rausch, some rare children overcome even the most difficult circumstances and grow up to lead well-adjusted, competent lives, while others become delinquent living under similar circumstances. She feels that the key to this successful growth on the part of the former is a characteristic of the child called resilience. Resilience is the ability to thrive, mature, and increase competence in the face of adverse circumstances. These circumstances may include biological abnormalities or environmental obstacles. Further, the adverse circumstances may be chronic and consistent or severe and infrequent. To thrive, mature, and increase competence, a person must draw upon all of his or her resources. Biological, psychological, and environmental. In a God-fearing Christian home, children should have all the opportunities they need to become resilient, to be able to master their world, to feel secure and safe, and not to worry about many of the disruptions that were mentioned earlier, such as divorce, desertion, or abuse. But Christian homes are at times dysfunctional. And when that happens, our children are put at risk. As Christ teaches in Matthew 19, that from the beginning God expected the family to consist of one man and one woman who were to take marriage seriously and not divorce for any reason other than adultery on the part of one or the other. In 1 Corinthians 7:11, we read that the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, let her remain single or else be reconciled, and that the husband should not divorce his wife. God wants the family unit to be one, to be cohesive. An omniscient God understands what is needed in the way of a family for the best conditions for rearing children. In the Bible, when a man took more than one wife, we find that the children and family had problems. Abraham was a fine man, chosen by God to bring forth a mighty nation of people. But when Sarah decided to help out by giving him Hagar, thus breaking God's rule, there were problems with the children, continuing problems. Jacob worked hard to obtain two wives and two concubines who gave him 12 sons, and we see delinquent behavior out of at least 10 of those sons. Solomon and David took many wives and suffered for it. We see delinquent behavior such as not listening to good advice, following peers, raping, killing, stealing, especially by the children of David. I'm not saying that children have to become delinquent when a parent disobeys God in breaking the marriage bond, but it does raise the risk for the children involved. God expects there to be one man and one woman in a marriage. One of the characteristics of many delinquent children is that they come from a home where there is a single parent, usually a mother, often deserted by the father. Look to Ephesians 5:21 through 6:4 for instruction on how God expects the marriage relationship to be and for some clue about why. Be subject to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. As the church is subject to Christ, so let wives also be subject in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. The mystery is a profound one, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. No, we do not get a manual with a new child. And granted, every child is special, different, and unique, but we do have a manual for marriage. And if we follow that manual and stay together, work out problems, show love and respect for each other, and think of our partner as part of us that we do not want to cause pain and anguish, our children will benefit and may choose to pattern their lives after two adults with whom they have a strong attachment, two adults they're able to love, trust, and respect. The single parent has a more difficult road in rearing children, especially if he or she has a child who's willing to take advantage of every opportunity to further his or her own wants and desires. Because there is no partner with whom to develop and enforce a plan of action. A single parent has less time, less energy, and often fewer resources to tackle the problems that such a child brings into the family. More than likely, that parent will have to work longer hours, and the child will have more unsupervised time than would be available in a two-parent family. A child on the way to becoming delinquent, even while very young, will watch for weakness in the defenses of a single parent and strike when the defenses are down. This child will know how to lay the blame squarely on the single parent for the child's behavior. Laying a guilt trip on the parent, which he or she does not deserve, but may accept, thereby allowing the child to win over and over again. And this child will also play two parents who have divorced or are separated. Both parents should still work together for the good of children involved, even if they are not together. If we have children or are going to have children and do not meet the criteria listed in Ephesians 5, we'd better make it right and reduce the disruptive risk factors for our children. God gave us the Old Testament for our example. God gave those examples for more than one reason. We have the Song of Songs to tell us how to love. We have the story of creation so that we have an answer to the question most people are still asking. Where did it all begin? We have stories of people who did right and people who did wrong so that we can learn from the good and the bad. We have the stories of Esther and of Ruth that let us know that even without a family, if we have one person who is good to us, one person who is decent and of good moral character who takes an interest in us, one person to whom we are attached and can trust to always be there for us, then we may take the high road. We have the story of Hannah, the mother of Samuel, who did not take him to serve God until she had formed a life bond with him. Eli, whose own two sons were delinquent in every way because he did not discipline them, gave instruction and care to Samuel so that he grew up to be just the opposite. The stories of Jacob and Esau show that favoritism for one child over the other by either parent caused distrust, dishonesty, and rebellion. David, a man after God's own heart, apparently did not teach his children morals, filial love, and loyalty. The good mother who came to Solomon for judgment was willing to give her child up instead of seeing him cut in half. Moses, who chose the beliefs of his parents over riches because of their teaching and ability to influence his life, became the leader of Israel. Many proverbs are addressed to parents as well as to children with instructions on rearing and training children. And in Deuteronomy 11:19, the Jews were to teach God's law to their children, talking of the laws when they were sitting in the house, walking by the way, when they laid down, and when they rose. And they were to be written upon the doorpost of their homes and gates, that their days and the nights of their children might be multiplied in the land. In other words, God knew that if the children were not taught His law, they would eventually be lost and lose the land. These principles are many of the same things that research shows help children to avoid becoming delinquent. Children need to develop a strong bond from birth. Babies who do not receive this attention languish, withdraw, and many of them die. Hopefully, the child will have the extra benefit of a caring attachment with a loving two-parent family, but if not, with a teacher, a grandparent, social worker, family friend, someone that he or she can trust to always be there. The child stands a better chance of being influenced for good and avoiding delinquent behavior. The child needs someone he can trust and confide in. It would be a relationship not unlike the relationship that existed between Esther and Mordecai. Mordecai took Esther in when her parents died. He became her confidant, her advisor. When Esther was taken into the royal harem, and even after she became the most powerful woman in the kingdom of Persia, she continued to confide in and listen to the advice of Mordecai. What a good relationship they must have had. Parents need to strive to have this kind of good relationship with their children. Trust. You can bet that when a child asks his parents for something which he knows is out of the question, knows is out of reason, something he shouldn't have or buy or whatever, he's testing them. If they say no, he may accuse them of not loving him, not trusting him, or berate them until eventually they give in because of guilt or because his words make them wonder if their child really feels this way about them. But by giving in to his demands, they are betraying his need to be able to trust them to do what is best for him. Consider Absalom and David in 2 Samuel 13. Although it had been 2 years since Absalom's sister had been raped by his half-brother Amnon, David should have known that Absalom had something up his sleeve when he asked that his half-brother Amnon be allowed to go up to the sheep shearing with him. David asked why, but the scripture says that more than once Absalom pressured him on the matter until he gave him permission. Later, he gave in to pressure again and allowed Absalom to come back to Jerusalem even though he had killed Amnon. Absalom, like any antisocial person, continued to take advantage of his father because he considered him weak and he had no trust in him. Children are looking for an authority figure that makes sense, not dictatorial, not mean and spiteful, but concerned for their well-being and willing to take the time to explain what rules are, why they exist, and how they relate to the child, and someone who will consistently enforce those rules with love and with the child's best interest in mind. Children need empathy. They need to be able to consider the feelings of others. Even very small children will stop what they're doing if they see someone crying, and may even try to comfort them. The delinquent child does not feel the need to do that because he's not learned that skill. If he hurts someone, he does not worry about it unless he gets caught. He may say he's sorry, but he's not sorry that he hurt the person, only that he got caught. His apology is not real, and he may only give it as a last resort to get out of trouble or for the benefit of someone else who's there to bail him out, usually the parent. These children are labeled just plain mean. In younger children, it usually involves bullying and then claiming that the other child started it. By the time this child is a teen, he might be involved in more serious matters, such as shooting someone. Empathy needs to be learned early and reinforced. Talk to the child about the feelings of others. Help them learn about empathy by example. Include them in your acts of kindness. Encourage them to be kind and to feel the pain and grief of others from a young age. Encourage them to associate with all children in their classroom. Often we try to shield our children from grief and pain, even of other people, but it may be the best opportunity to teach this lesson of empathy. Apparently, Rehoboam in 1 Kings 12 did not learn much about empathy or about respect for his elders. When he took over his father's throne, he did not listen to the advice of the elders, nor did he feel the pain of the people. And because of that, he lost most of the kingdom. Esther, on the other hand, learned empathy for others. When she learned of the plot of Haman against the Jewish people, she could have kept quiet. She could have saved herself. Instead, we read in Esther 4:16 her reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Esther had to be encouraged by Mordecai to do this. But it was obvious that she'd learned empathy earlier in order to make such a great decision. All children need the ability to share. Parents teach children to share their toys with other children. When children are small, they're more into parallel play, playing near each other instead of with each other. But as parents or siblings encourage them, they begin to actually play with others. And play becomes a time of give and take, being fair, and learning to be a good loser and a good winner. And children who do not learn these things feel that they are owed something. They should win every time, and they make their own rules to do so. In the story of the lost son in Luke 15, there are two sons, and one son seems delinquent through his behavior, leaving, wasting money, and lifestyle. But the other son also has lessons to learn. And we see the father teaching. Teaching your children does not end when they're 18. It still continues. They're still your baby. Everybody knows that. Even though they may be gone and they have their own husband or wife and those things, they still sometimes need that advice. And here we have a father whose son is still at home, and he's teaching. Coaching the son who stayed at home after this son realizes that the lost son has come home and is being treated well. We read, "But he was angry and would not go in. And therefore his father came out and pleaded with him. So he answered and said to his father, 'Lo, these many years I've been serving you. I never transgressed your commandment at any time. And yet you never gave me a young goat that I might make merry with my friends. But as soon as this son of yours came, who has devoured your livelihood with harlots, you kill the fatted calf for him. And the father said, Son, you're always with me, and all that I have is yours. It was right that we should make merry and be glad. For your brother was dead and is alive again, and was lost and is found. Teaching moment. The second son did not want to share what he had with his brother. That does not mean that he had never learned to share. But under the circumstances, he didn't want to at that particular time. The father's speech was meant to reassure his son, something that every parent needs to do often with children. Reassure our children that we love them by telling them and showing them, not with things, but with our time and our devotion. Nothing is the delinquent child's fault. Unless he has something to gain, or being at fault makes him a winner. And that's one of the reasons that school is a problem for delinquent children. There are rules and work, and if a child does not get the good grade, he does not accept the responsibility for it. It becomes the teacher's fault for not giving fair tests, or the dog's fault for eating the homework, but it's certainly not his fault. When school rules are broken by this child, he tells his parents or any adult who will listen to him a story that absolves him of any blame. If something is stolen, even though it may be found on his person, he did not do it, and will find someone to blame. As a teacher and an elementary principal, I've sat through many explanations of how it was not a child's fault when I knew he was guilty. Often the parent would come in the same or the following day to let me know that I should be punishing this other child because their child was definitely not in the wrong. This action is called denial. And sometimes I sing a little song called Queen of Denial, but a little different. But parents who are going in that direction are headed for trouble. David certainly continued in denial that Absalom was bad to the core. After Absalom led a revolt against his father, David ordered the soldiers to deal gently with the young man. Parents who continually deny that their child is in the wrong and bail him out of every problem the child is responsible for hurt that child by not teaching him to face the consequences of his actions and prepare him for accepting responsibility in the future. Admitting that there is a problem and that your child is at fault is not admitting failure as a parent. This admission may be the first step to help the child or to find professional help that will give some guidance about what needs to be happening in the child's life to keep him from becoming more delinquent. Self-esteem is needed by all children and by all people. Parents are not depriving them of it by giving them discipline. God instructs us to discipline, not through physical abuse, but with consistency, instruction, and the rod if needed. Some children who are brought up in a totally permissive climate without discipline are insecure, feeling unloved and uncared for. Proverbs teaches us that parents should give instruction and discipline to their children, and that children should listen and follow. Proverbs 1, verse 8, Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and reject not your mother's teaching. Proverbs 2, verse 1, My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments with you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. Proverbs 2:20. So you will walk in the way of good men and keep to the paths of godliness. And then Proverbs 3 and verse 4 says, so you will find favor and good repute in the sight of God and man. And what more could you want in the way of self-esteem than to find favor with God and man? That would definitely validate your worth as a person. Self-esteem is more than just feeling good about you. Self-esteem is being able to make mistakes and learn from them in a positive way. Self-esteem is being able to take another person's criticism and put it into perspective. Self-esteem is having goals, reaching them, and knowing that you can reach them. And self-esteem enables a person to give and receive love, admiration, honest praise. Self-esteem is empowering and allows the person to empower others without feeling like he's losing anything of his own. Delinquents do not have this kind of self-esteem. Their esteem is temporary or fleeting. It often depends not on empowering, but on taking power or things away from others. How often have parents felt powerless when dealing with a delinquent child? Parents have to take that power back. When I began first grade, there were a lot of children that started with me, but they didn't graduate with me. Many of them dropped out early. And I realized from an early age that some children seem destined to have those problems because they do not have the things that they need to cope. As a teacher and an administrator, I've met many in my field and in other fields who cater only to those who have and give them more at the expense of those who are really, truly in need. In fact, some of these individuals encourage delinquency by not having the same high expectations for all children, putting them down or making them feel powerless. But on the other hand, I've also had that experience with those people who go the extra mile. One such individual was my sixth grade teacher, Jessie Bertram, who would sit on her porch steps and ask me questions and talk to me as if I were an adult when I would drop by her house after school in the afternoons or on Saturdays. I was probably a nuisance, but she never treated me like one. And she didn't treat any other child like one either. You knew where you stood with Ms. Bertram. You worked for Ms. Bertram because she expected it. When I began teaching, she was there to encourage and explain what children needed. Years later, when I was principal and visited my former elementary school to make observations with some of my teaching staff, in walked Ms. Bertram in her 80s. She'd come to read to the children that might not have somebody at home to read to them. Storekeepers, policemen, restaurant owners, and waiters, my neighbors, definitely influenced me to stay on the right path. By just showing an interest, by knowing my name, and at times by letting me know they were going to call my mother or my grandmother. At about age 8, I was the proud owner of a peacoat. Those of you who are older will know maybe what that is, but it's a big old heavy black short coat, big thick thing, big buttons. Best coat I ever had in my life, I guess. And I learned from Paul and Silas, who were in the third grade with me, one was 15 and one was 16, that after school, if we dropped by the corner drugstore and we wore a big coat and went to the candy counter, that you could very easily slip a Tootsie Roll or some other nice piece of candy right in that sleeve. And as long as you held it up like this and walked out, you could get out with it. Well, Paul and Silas didn't last real long in the third grade either. They moved on, and unfortunately both made the prison rolls later. But when I was on my own one day, I go into the corner drugstore and I had on my pea coat and I sauntered over to the candy bar and I was helping myself. And the clerk comes over and she called me by name. And she said, "I saw what you did. You know that's not right. Your granny would not like that. Your mother would not like that. I give you a choice. You can put it back and never do that again, or I can go ahead and call them now." Of course, I swore to her I would never, ever do that again, because I knew what would happen if she called my granny or my mother. But she took an interest in me. When I started high school, I went back to work at that drugstore. And obviously, I knew how to catch a shoplifter. Okay. We need to take an interest in the children in our communities. After retiring, I took a job as a part-time math instructor, resource teacher for our alternative high school. And one young man, about 19 years of age, who looked to be 30, he was bigger than me, real muscular guy, hairy. He began coming to my room because I was the new guy and he thought he could just waltz in and do what he wanted. So he would come in and immediately try to go to sleep. And I never had maybe 15 kids in there, so I'd go over, sit with him and say, "What have you got to work on?" I don't have anything. Yeah, it was, anyway, I eventually told him, I said, "If you're going to come in here, we're going to work. And I will sit with you and work with you as long as you're in here. But if you're not going to come in here to work, then don't come in here. You can go to one of the other rooms." Okay, I'll work. So he got out his math. We worked on his math. But he really did have a problem being sleepy. And I found out that he was working a job at a fast food restaurant. He got off at 2:30 or later in the morning. Ran home, tried to get a little sleep in a really totally dysfunctional household where everything in the world was going on. And then he would come to school the next morning dead. And one morning he came in and I'm forcing him to work with me and we're working, but he cannot stay awake. I mean, it's not, he's trying really hard, but he can't do it. So I went to the principal and I said, "He really cannot stay awake. I'm going to find a cot. Find him a place to sleep." And I did. He slept a couple hours and then came back and worked with me. Well, at semester, I changed jobs. And Kay and I went out to eat at a Mexican restaurant 2 days after I left the job. And we're walking out the door of the restaurant on Sunday afternoon, and this little car goes zipping by. And all of a sudden it screeches to a halt and this bearded head sticks out the window and it says, yells at me, "Mr. Thurman, when are you coming back? I need your help." So I told him, I said, I'll come and see you tomorrow because the alternative high school and the central office are in the same facility. So the next day I went up, I made arrangements with him and his principal for him to come down and work with me. I was able to do that. I talked with my boss. They were fine. And I worked with him and another boy on math till the end of the year. And they both graduated and asked me to be there. We need to take an interest in the children in our community, not just those that are ours. We can't just be judgmental, which is the easiest thing in the world to do. How we relate to children in our families, our neighborhoods, or our communities may make a difference. We're told to judge not, lest ye be judged. And perhaps we need to be most careful about this matter with children. You may be the person who can so influence a child that he may take a turn that will lead him or her to become a responsible citizen. Whatever tact you take in trying to help any child, remember to do the following. Be honest. Be there. Listen. Be slow to speak. Care. Be consistent. And pray. You may or may not be entirely successful, but at least you'll have tried. Thank you.